If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. Discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Hello and welcome to Weekends with me, Jason Olborn, here on TNT Radio. We are live and we're going to go full speed ahead today and tomorrow on the show. We are working really hard behind the scenes to make sure that we bring you the best possible information. That's what TNT is all about, isn't it? It's not just about presenting alternate news, as it were, but finding the facts about what is going on and presenting to you the world's best information as we here at TNT Radio attempt to become the world's best news source. And we do that by looking beyond the narrative that is sold to us, because that's where all problems start. And that's why we do what we do here. This show is dedicated to digging in deep into a lot of different subjects. Many you will be aware of, but some, of course, you will not. And today's show will be no different. Coming up in the next hour, I've got Dave Hodges from the Common Sense Show, and he's going to go all out with his ability to make things look simple to the world that makes it anything but. In the third hour, I'm going to have Geoffrey Benn, an Australian historian. Almost on the eve of Anzac Day, we're going to explore one of the great catastrophes in Australian military history, one of the darkest days where we lost the most individual soldiers ever on that particular occasion over 100 years ago. And as we approach Anzac Day, it makes sense to then realise what the day is all about. And in the final hour of today's show, we're going to cross to New Delhi, where I'm going to speak to Manish Jha, a journalist from TV9, who has over 700 million people watching that channel. And we're going to talk Indian elections, BRICS, and all sorts of information coming out of that country, the world's most populous, how it is that India, along with China, can run their own race while the rest of us are playing this climate change funny story that's going on in the world that it seems is not just a two-speed economy, a two-energy economy. Very, very strange world, but we'll get that perspective as well. Now, I'm really excited to tell you about my first guest today, and his name is Michael McCarron. Let me tell you a little bit more. And just so we're just aware, for those that aren't aware, just quickly an aside, American ships and troops in the Middle East have prepared for a likely Iranian attack on Israel on Friday as President Joe Biden urged Tehran to change its mind. I just want to bring you up to speed on this. Iranian leaders have vowed to punish Israel for the April 1 airstrike in the consulate at Damascus, Syria, that killed seven officers of the elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including two of its generals. Biden's message in Friday, which is where it is in the US at the moment, the ending of Friday, don't, is what he said. Biden also added, we are devoted to the defense of Israel, will support Israel, will help defend Israel, and Iran will not succeed, he added. So all eyes on what's happening there in the Middle East as two aircraft carriers have been turned around. Sorry, we'll get back onto the show. Now, I want to read a little bit more about Michael's book, and then I'm going to introduce you to him. We're going to get stuck into this conversation. Now, the Nazis never surrendered and planned their Fourth Reich using neurocognitive weapons, going underground, and their technology made its way to South America, the Soviet Union, the US, among other places. We're all bound by the new rules of corporate fascism, long planned by Himmler, and his main strategy for a Fourth Reich financial control. Are we all just living in a computer-controlled information battle space continued from World War II? It's a good question. I know I've been asking that for a long time. Well, Michael's book, Battle Space of Mind, it dissects the matrix of control used by advanced military industrial powers. Breaks down the technology bit by bit so you have an understanding how technology is being used in a battle for your mind, and he will address the issues from a veteran's insight as a former signals intelligence specialist and with some background in the intelligence community, brings forth countermeasures to this control, showing you how you can safeguard your mind, that's right, your mind from these attacks, countermeasures that are not available anywhere in the commercial world, yet without them you'll be easy prey for the directed, targeted, pulse-modulated attacks first used by the Nazis. Well, have I got your attention? Now, Michael McCarron was a signals intelligence analyst with the US Navy, serving on fast attack submarines, and has a background in the intelligence community. As I said before, he's a software engineer by profession with a focus on cybersecurity, specializing in cyber threats to human biology. Michael McCarron, welcome to Weekends.
Good morning, or I should say good day to you. Yes, Battlespace of Mind is a work that goes over what we call neuroweapons. But the question is, what is a neuroweapon to like most people who aren't familiar with these things don't really understand what it is. Basically, what a neuroweapon is something that can alter your physiology, including inside your brain. So in this, it's a form of electronic warfare. You're using electronic signals to target physiology inside a human being. So what happened was a lot of people think a neuroweapon started being developed in the 1950s. Most books that talk about neuroweapons start in the 1950s with things like Project Artichoke and other things. Actually, neuroweapons were started to be developed in the 1920s by Germans after their defeat in World War I. The first person to really back research financially into neuroweapons was the Krupps, K-R-U-P-P-E. If you're German, you'll be familiar with this very large corporation that dealt in armaments back then. As the Germans were trying to deal with losing World War I, they also were trying, the far right of German society started developing political parties like the Nazis. The Nazis were infiltrated by the German Reichswehr, and that's the German military. They're the generals, like General Ludendorff, who was a very famous far-right German general. What they were doing was cultivating various groups to take political power back because they wanted the military to be powerful again. In German society, the military is a very powerful institution, especially in Prussia, where the Prussians saw themselves as like Spartans. They're a very militaristic kind of a lifestyle. What they sought to do was, just as you would do any campaign for anything, it involves information. So what they sought to do was control the political organizations, which they did, and Hitler was sent in to the National Socialists. But before that, he was just a common intelligence agent, primarily working on propaganda and delivering speeches, which is how he learned to deliver those great speeches and why he was so, the people were galvanized by his speaking style, which was all taught to them, taught to Hitler by German intelligence. Now, later on, in the Soviet Union at the same time, the German Reichswehr, the German military, signed a secret agreement with Soviets to develop military technology. One of the areas that they started developing military technology in was brain science. The Germans and the Soviets created a joint brain institute for the study of the brain. Out of that came this one Russian scientist named Vasiliev. Vasiliev used hypnosis and electromagnetic waves to try and influence people. And this is, you know, like I said, this is in the 1920s and 1930s. In 1939, I think it was, the first studies started being published about using microwaves to influence brain function. Another thing that the Germans developed back then was the EEG, even though EEGs had been created previously in Russia. The idea that you can record brain waves is another, came out of the same time period when they were looking at new ways to influence people and to control narratives. And there's no better way to control a narrative if you can, you know, just directly steer people however you, which way you want them to go with this technology.
There's so much to be able to dissect in here, Michael. Before we sort of dig into it a little bit more, I'm fascinated by how it is that within the intelligence community and within the military itself, how it is that that you've decided to spend years putting this information together, and why it is that it doesn't become more mainstream from the point of view that it still seems to be incredibly secretive. And here you are putting this incredible book together, this incredible work to get it out. Why Is it because it's a military project, therefore, something that the United States technically has brought over from Nazi Germany? Is this the reason why it's still secret technology, because of this idea of warfare? Or is this some sort of control over humanity, the clandestine approach of military around the world? How does it all come together like this?
Yeah, these are really good questions. Culpability is what I call it. Who's really culpable for these things? We know various militaries, various intelligence agencies have used these technologies. The most famous example of using this technology was during the first Persian Gulf War, where the United States used this technology to guide Iraqi soldiers to surrender to them by pretending to be the voice of God inside their head to tell them to surrender to the Americans. That's like one of the earliest examples of the latest technology, the latest form of this technology being used. If anybody who has worked in intelligence will tell you one thing that's true about intelligence: nation state and military intelligence is a very small part of espionage. The people who are most involved in espionage are business people. In the business world, espionage, you know, just intellectual property issues, stealing other people's intellectual property. So this is what I always try to tell people to be cautious with, is if you view it as like some nation state spy games, or, you know, the great game, so to speak, I don't think we really quite are grasping who I suspect is ultimately culpable is some kind of rich and powerful business interests who can use this technology to basically control the market. In my software engineering, I'm actually developing a financial technology app. And in the study of financial technology, stock trading, commodities, currencies, one thing you notice is the complete automation of everything. Like, my technology that I've developed is an automated algorithm. Everything is done by the computer. It's completely automated. And this is how all the financial businesses are being done these days. Everything is completely automated. It's a computer system that is doing, you know, all the trading, deciding how many assets to move into this place or that place. So, having said that, my suspicion is that what we're dealing with are people who, you cannot control the marketplace. You know what I mean? Like, if you just let the market run naturally, it's going to do all kinds of different things. It's really hard to consistently make money in the market unless you can control the market. And that's ultimately what I think this system is really about. And it's my personal belief, and I can't, you know, I don't have direct scientific evidence about this, is that it's a worldwide system where everybody is viewed as just an object in this computer system, and they are trying to get everybody to spend as much money as possible into their interests and to deny other people's interests. The whole reason I wrote this book is because I noticed I was being targeted by something. I didn't know what it was. It wasn't until I started looking into these things. In the military, I was on fast attack submarines, and we were deployed in the Middle East. So when you go on deployment, you get into situations where there are all kinds of different people from different military backgrounds working together on a special operation, and you talk to those people. One of these people I talked to told me about this thing called remote viewing, which, you know, when I first heard about remote viewing, I thought it was, oh, come on, are you kidding me? There's no way remote viewing can be possible. But then I started noticing how weird my life had become, and that I was being directly targeted and followed and being surveilled. You know, if you're in the military, you can tell when people are surveilling you and stuff like that. So I wanted to know how they were doing it. So I started doing all this research. There are several academic researchers who are working in this area. A lot of the topics in this book are not repeated in any of the other books, and I did that deliberately. One of the best books about neuroweapons was written by an East Carolina University professor named Krishnan, and he's cited in my book. And there is a free version of my book, a free PDF version of my book on the internet on my GitHub account. But another academic working in this area is a Russian. He was originally Russian, And he moved to Germany, and his name is Serge Kurenbach. Now, in Canada, an American named Dr. Michael Persinger also did a lot of research, and that's what the countermeasures are based on, is the research of Michael Persinger in Canada.
Now, Michael, I'll get you to hold that thought just for a moment because we need to go to a break, and we're going to come back and get into the details of this incredible book, Battle Space of Mind, with Michael McCarron. Now, before we go to the break, if you love a good documentary, then you'll love our special screenings. Uninterrupted Cinema features some of the latest or notable documentaries from the world's best filmmakers. You can check out TNT's website for more information. Weekends are better when you spend it with us here on today's News Talk TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Today's News Talk Radio.
I do a lot of streaming radio.
I do a lot of free streaming.
TNTradio.live.
And welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is the author of Battle Space of Mind, Michael McCarron. And just before the break, we got to talk literally about the men who stare at goats, Michael. Remote viewing, isn't it incredible that something can grab your attention like that and you question it, and then the opposite happens? Suddenly something else comes to mind. It's quite incredible, the whole idea behind remote viewing. But this is just forming the basis of, I guess, the framework that's led to this book that you've put together.
Well, The Men Who Stare at Goats is an interesting phenomena. This is also one of the things that, when you look at who is developing this technology, is we're talking about a special military unit within the American military, The Men Who Stare at Goats. It was somebody who was not directly a member of that group who clued me into, you know, remote viewing. But what is remote viewing? Remote viewing is telepathy, right? But what is telepathy a technology, or is it supernatural? When the German Navy, they actually had experiments in World War II for remote viewing. They were trying to geolocate British ships to sink them, using special psychic techniques. But the what grew out of this special military union in the German Navy was the idea that it is a physical a question of physics. Now, when the Russians started developing this technology, what had happened was in World War II, with the surrender of the German military again in World War II, the Soviets and the Americans were after scientists. The Soviets were way behind in the nuclear program. So they took all the Germans' scientists working in the nuclear program. Some of these scientists, like Von Arden was one of the names of these scientists. He was a very influential businessman and developer of technology, and created some of the first attempts to copy the thoughts from one person into the thought into the brain of another person. Their thoughts were being copied. This is what he was trying to do. And he went to the Soviet Union, and where in the Soviet Union, where these remote influencing technologies started to be developed, was directly out of these labs that were led by these German scientists. And some of them actually were awarded with medals by the Soviet Union for their contributions to the nuclear program, and eventually ended up living back in East Germany, for instance, or even were liberated to West Germany. What this reveals is that Soviets were focused on gravitation. Now, most people had thought telepathy was like an electromagnetic phenomenon. What the Soviets discovered, or what we read from the literature that suggests, it's very suggestive that that's what they were focused on, was the use of gravitational waves. Now, you can use gravitational waves to create electromagnetic waves, and you can use electromagnetic waves to create gravitational waves. They transduce back into each other. And one of the chief criticisms, and I want to bring this to attention. One of the chief criticisms of people who say this technology is impossible is because people are saying it affects them everywhere they go, including in shielded areas. And there's only a couple particles that can actually penetrate something. An electromagnetic wave cannot penetrate very far. A gravitational wave can penetrate through anything. So if you, when you look at the movies and you see all the special operations going on deep down in bunkers for their, you know, security and privacy, with this technology, that's not true. With this technology, you can penetrate anything. If you go to Washington, D.C. and you look at some of the intelligence agencies' windows or the FBI windows, they have these filters around the windows, which is supposed to block radio frequencies. Against this technology, that too is also completely worthless. It will not block this technology. What was interesting, going back to the remote viewing thing, Dr. Michael Persinger was doing some research around 2000 with a very famous remote viewer named Ingo Swann. And what he discovered is there was a way to block Ingo Swann from remote viewing, and that was to use rhythmically changing electromagnetic waves in a circular hoop or a toroid. It's a very significant discovery that you could actually block remote viewing, which means you can also block the same technology, even when we're using technology to create telepathy, the same principle applies. I tested this out on myself. You know, what Dr. Persinger had done was created a coil, and he created a video series about building these coils. It was not for the purposes of countering remote viewing or remote electromagnetic influencing or using microwaves to influence you. But what he sought to do was in his experiments, he was joined in the minds of two different people through entanglement, quantum entanglement. And you could, through EEG readings, they were able to see that there was a result that even though people were separated by 3,000 kilometers, they were able to transfer thoughts. And you could see it in their brainwaves because they're recording with EEG, they're recording the brainwaves, and they could see this. Now, in the countermeasure version of this experiment, he was using two hoops to create two separate spaces and join those spaces through quantum entanglement. This is just using one hoop. And if you use an accelerating frequency of electromagnetic waves and you change the rhythm a little bit each time, anything inside that toroid, inside the middle of the toroid that it encircles, will be protected from this technology. And that is like one of the countermeasures. The Soviet scientists who worked on this technology after the Germans went back to Germany, they also developed countermeasures. But in Russian society, just like in Western society, the idea of talking about this technology is viewed and labeled and condemned as pseudoscience. it's very interesting that these Russian scientists who developed this technology, now most of them live, they don't have any funding. They don't have any, you know, companies. They tried to start companies, but they always flounder. But they did develop countermeasures. They developed their own countermeasures separate from what Dr. Michael Persinger developed and what I have focused on. So I want to make people, I want to make sure that people understand that there are ways to deal with this remote influencing. But all those, nobody has led any major effort at doing scientific research or production of countermeasures anywhere on the face of the planet. Now, going back to the pseudoscience labeling of this technology, we have to understand that how powerful this technology is. I mean, if you could influence everybody around you and you're a businessman, how long would it take you to become like one of the most powerful business people around? You know, you can just imagine just how powerful a technology like this would be. And to maintain its covert, you know, layer where they can do whatever they want with this technology is of tantamount importance. But the main reason they don't want people to know about this technology is because they use the technology, and the governments themselves are using this technology for their own influence in other nation states. And they're not going to, like the Americans always say, is we don't disclose our intelligence practices, or, you know, we keep everything close to our chest. And until we can get, I mean, any government, I would I'd be happy with any government just saying that we have this technology and here are some countermeasures and we're going to fund, you know, this development of this research against this technology, which is fundamentally a biological weapon. And biological weapons are banned. The only country that hasn't signed on to banning biological weapons is the state of Israel. So there's lots of nations that are using this technology, but so far, you know, nobody, because it's so easy to cover it up, nobody's come forward with saying, you know, this is a real thing. They just label everything pseudoscience to protect their own intelligence assets.
There's so much, isn't there, to unpack in the statements that you've made there, Michael, but it starts to fill in gaps for our audience who are watching and listening and thinking, my goodness me. So it's one cover story on top of another cover story. And in that explanation, I mean, how does it affect a businessman? I'm thinking, so pre-Windows, when we had, you know, DOS computers, and then, of course, Bill Gates comes along and creates a product that everyone wants, and Windows, everyone has a Windows computer for some period of time. And then you fast forward 30 years, and all of a sudden, here's a businessman who's got a solution to make you all healthy. All he needs is some sort of virus to get out that his medicine can work. It's quite extraordinary, and this is the great mind control scenario that we're in at the moment, in a period of censorship. Where you can't talk about it. I'm going to quote something actually from your book. It's in the intro, Matthew Roser. If you don't mind, I'll read something from it for everyone's benefit. This is from the book Battle Space of Mind in the intro. It was easier to dislodge untruths before social media. In social media, people tend to take public positions. When that position turns out to be wrong, it's embarrassing. And backing down is typically seen as weakness. So the double down on untrue claims to save face and personal credibility, we are way too emotionally attached to being right. It would be better for our culture as a whole to value uncertainty and intellectual humility and curiosity. Those values help us ask questions without the expectation of permanent answers. That's from Matthew Roser, the psychological reason that so many fall for the big lie. Michael, it's devastating to think what's going on here. It seems that that when we talk about, I mean, people talk about the idea, if we just complete aside Roswell 1947 and those people following down that pathway say, well, we've lost 70 years of technology. But when you think of what's going on here in information warfare, technically a bioweapon playing with our own minds, the general public in many ways must feel like it's centuries behind what's being used against them. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, well, yeah, that's, you know, when I was in the Navy, we always talked about maintaining a technological edge against the Soviets. We always tried to stay like 20 years ahead of them. Military industrial complex, their technology is always far more advanced than what is available in the marketplace to common public citizens. Again and again, I just kind of like reiterate, you know, it's, we like to focus on nation states, we like to focus on the military, but I'm pretty sure this is all about making money. And it's interesting that, you know, I'm not the first person to think this way. When this technology was first being developed in the 1920s, there was a Russian science fiction writer named Belyaev, and he heard about people researching in this way back in his day. And he wrote a book about how a German banker, like a middle-ranking officer in the German bank, used this technology to take control of the bank. Then he used that bank to control all the German banks and then the world. And it was, the book is actually called Ruler of the World. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? I mean, that somebody could use electromagnetic waves, microwaves, and computers to automate those things and control the world to make money. But my gut feeling is that that's really ultimately what we're looking at. We'd like to focus on like the state within a state, you know, and blame like some secret government cabal. But if you think about who could be using this, if it's the government that's using this to control its own citizens or the citizens of other nations, eventually somebody's going to say something about it. There's going to be a whistleblower. Like in the metadata Snowden leaks, when he released his information about how they were tracking all these emails, he's a whistleblower, and there are other whistleblowers who also, it wasn't just Snowden that whistleblew, there are many whistleblowers. But so far, we haven't seen any whistleblowers. But if you were to try to do this, why would you do it within the government or within a state, knowing that they're going to use the laws of that state and government to try and stop you or audit you or in some way interfere with your ability to do those things, because you have to follow oversight. Right? Somebody in the government has to look at your work and say, is this a moral or legal thing to do? And like I said, it's a biological weapon. So no, it's not a moral or legal thing to do. It's a biological weapon. I guess I'll stop there.
This, again, it's very confusing, isn't it? Because if the argument perhaps is just as a money-making mechanism and an absolute power over the decision-making of somebody, how they spend their money, therefore it makes sense. But the end game is, you know, if you get all the money in the world, you know, then what? Perhaps, you know, what's the next agenda? And then, of course, when you consider, you know, some sort of deep state cabal or government controlling the world, again, to what end? And then you look at this information and you wonder if it was the Fourth Reich that comes to, you know, South America, United States, etc., and sets up again, is this the same ideology that stemmed from Nazi Germany? So therefore, one would ask, what was the purpose of Nazi Germany if it went on to win the war? World War II, where would we be today? Would it be a case that there would be some form of New World Order controlled by Nazi Germany and we'd all have to be underlings or subservient or slaves to that system? And then to come across to the United States, et cetera, and see what happens. And it seems that all roads lead to this idea of one world government or some sort of control. And the COVID era can't be discounted from any of the work that you're doing when you consider that if the solution is worse than the cause, as it seems every day it is, then what's that outcome? Is it a case of thinning out the population again for control? But that goes against the argument of we're all in this for money. So there's so many competing ideas, Michael, and I love the fact that that the incredible amount of work that you've done has led to draw you some of these conclusions that you're at the moment. We're going to take another break, but what I was hoping we'll do after the break is get into some more of the technology and the understanding of what you've talked about, such as AI, cybernetics. You've talked about automated control, and I also want to talk about quantum consciousness. These are terms that that people who have been watching along are starting to draw bows. Perhaps it's coming from their spiritual development, understanding of different ways that the world may be progressing, because there's got to be a counterbalance to all that's going on technologically. And if people can somehow develop their own skills of telepathy, goodness me, you've got a whole new world opening. And then, of course, if there's a power for absolute good, again, against the power of absolute power, there's something else going on. It's a remarkable book, a remarkable conversation. We'll take that break now and we'll come back with more. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats. Mark sheer
athleticism. It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom. And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
You ever heard of a polyp? Sounds like a rare species of toad. Actually, it's a lump that grows inside me, your bowel. Look, I'm pretty sure if you had a strange lump growing on your forehead, you might get it looked at, right? But when they're growing inside me, nothing, nada. And the polyps I get can lead to Australia's second deadliest cancer. So, until there's a way to make them grow on your face, it's up to you to get me looked at. Got it?
When you need to know what's going on around the world, stay with Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. This is the show that I promise I will challenge every single neuron that's sitting inside that beautiful skull of yours as we determine what we do, not only to understand this seeming collapse or change in the world as we know it, where if you think outside the square, you're the bad guy, versus what happens in an eventual collapse of any system, the fall of Rome or whatever it is. What do we do afterwards? So on this show, whilst I'll provide information in the lead up to that great big change, if and when it comes, and then what do we do afterwards to make the world a better place in the name of freedom, prosperity, and abundance. Who knew you could actually talk about such things? If you watched government behave today, all I'll tell you is doom, gloom, more gloom, and you are the carbon that we want to reduce. Well, after that rant, let's get back to the book. Michael McCarron's book, Battle Space of Mind, is an absolute powerhouse of information. You can pick it up on Amazon or you can go to Trine Day Publishing. In Australian dollars, it's about $40, money well spent. There's also a Kindle option I've noticed there for only about $3, another way to get your book digitally if you like, to be able to build up your collection. This is information that you will not get anywhere else. Michael, I know we're going to run out of time. We've only got about 15 minutes left. So I wanted to touch on a couple of the chapter titles for a brief explanation so that we can explain it to people who will pick up the book. Chapter 5, AI, Cybernetics, Automated Control, and Reflexive Management. Can you explain what you set out to do there?
Yes. Well, when the Soviets started developing these influence technologies, they were also developing what was known as reflexive control. Reflexive control is the ability for me to influence you to get you to do what I want you to do. This is usually used in politics or on the battlefield. Reflexive control became automated by the Soviets right at around the same time that the use of electronic warfare became automated. A lot of people don't realize that in terms of the 1970s and the early 80s, that in terms of computer technology, the Soviets were actually way ahead of the West. They had more advanced computer technology, so they thought more along these lines of automating everything. One of the things they came up with in these programs was what they called the single warrior model, which was a computer controls everything, and the computer just doesn't control everything. The computer can also update itself and write its own programming, so it can adapt to its to what it perceives to need. I don't know how many people are actually comfortable with an AI system deciding all the things that the AI system is going to be able to do, but that can open up, you know, as you can imagine, it's a Pandora's box if you fully automate something as dangerous as controlling people's minds. The people who are in control of the hardware can be easily controlled by the hardware in the end. And that's one of the dilemmas that we're in with automation, artificial intelligence, and cybernetics.
Let me just pause at that for a moment. At what point, therefore, if this is applied, are we not living in a matrix? Technically, we're just puppet strings of someone else is controlling us completely. Isn't that the point of where we are at the matrix level at that stage?
Yeah, that's what they were seeking. This is exactly what they're seeking. They're seeking the ability to control other people. They always call this is the research that goes into this always falls under the rubric of anti-terrorism. The Soviets had another term for it, and that was corrective behavior. They were trying to correct dissidents to the authoritarian Marxist-Leninist, whose dictatorship, which, you know, anybody that has developed this technology has always ended up being an authoritarian government. It doesn't matter if it's left or right. But I think I lost my stream of thought.
Well, no, it's unbelievable, really, what we're talking about. And and again, I just can't rave enough about the work that you've put together in this book. And there's a lot to discuss. If we can move on just quickly, Quantum Consciousness, Chapter 8. It's hard to understand, but I was hoping that perhaps you can explain where this fits in, and if you can explain what it is and how it fits into the big picture, and one would assume into humanity's future, if humanity even has a future.
Yeah. Well, quantum consciousness is something that has been developing in the neurocognitive sciences for a while. The reason it's brought into this work is because I'm citing a specific Lockheed Martin military industrial complex engineer named John Norsine, who developed something called thought injection. And in the process of his work in developing thought injection, which he got from visiting the Russians after the fall of the Soviet Union, he was working for Lockheed Martin. He went to Russia to study reflexive control and these other technologies. He brought it back to Lockheed Martin, and then they built the same systems that the Soviets had based on those systems. The NSA was very interested in bringing Soviet researchers over here to study these things. And what he terms one of his techniques for injecting these thoughts is quantum key shifting. And this affects your brain state. What scientists think that in the classical world, like biological beings belong to a classical world, not the quantum world. They don't believe that, you know, you can influence things on the quantum level and that will bubble up to the classical level. But John Norsine believed that, and the evidence is that he was right about quantum consciousness, that you can affect consciousness using quantum technology. Because all biological existence, and there's something called quantum biology that goes into this, it comes from the very micro level of existence, the quantum level of existence, where time and space don't function like it does in the classical world. So that's how we got to quantum consciousness. It was out of the work of John Norsine because he believed that the brain was based in quantum technology and used quantum technology to affect brains and inject thoughts.
Now, where does the connection to holograms or holography, I think the term is, how does that all connect?
Holographic information, this is something the Soviet researchers were looking into. I didn't really go much into holography other than to, you know, cite this research. So I wrote this book as like a starting point for other people to build on, to develop, that people who have a background in physics, have a background in neurocognitive sciences, could look at it and take it more seriously, because most people, like I said, they write it off as pseudoscience. So we need these people who will specialize in these things to take this further and develop technology to, not only to counter it, but also so we can understand how it works And the benefits that could come out of developing these things are tremendous. There's even the possibility that some of the implications of this technology being real can also affect such things as space flight, going out into space, colonizing of the galaxy and stuff like this, because our whole picture of the world gets blown apart. Basically, once we realize that what we have been told and what we have been told is pseudoscience is just a cover story to protect military intelligence assets or business assets, if you will.
It's very, very powerful. There are many historians, researchers out there in the ET community talking about, for example, a secret space program. Is that stretching the friendship a little bit far, or is that something that could be well in the realms of hidden technology?
I don't know if there's a secret space program, but if there is a secret space program, then you would have to ask yourself who controls it. And it would probably be the same people who control this system that I believe is in existence on our planet here. But once you break down, you know, this is like an invitation to everybody and very much the tradition of open source, you know, programming and stuff like that. I put out all the information I found. I've cited it academic. I use academic citation styles in my work. So everybody who has an academic background can go to those resources and look this information up and read those papers and do their own experiments to see if it's true or false or not on their own. But even scientific replication experiments has been shown to be, you know, flawed. like when they discovered gravitational waves, they tried to debunk gravitational waves. And the person who discovered it, an American named Weber, eventually, I mean, they called him a pseudoscientist, and they had a very emotional, strong reactions to the discovery of gravitational waves. We're in an uphill fight against a lot of leverage that is against the common person. It's going to take a lot. We have to be, you know, we have to strive. We have to struggle. We have to work for bringing a better world. If we don't do that work, if we don't do research, if we don't speak out on various topics that we feel that we need to speak out on, and we should always respect each other's opinions and be loving and respectful towards each other as good neighbors. We need to do the work. We need to do the research. And this is an invitation to other people to look at this work, take it seriously. There are real academics who have done real research on this, and they are not pseudoscientists. And if we don't do that, there could be great suffering on our planet, because they will just let this program run until the wheels fall off the bus. And if it is actually a program controlling those who own the hardware, there is no way to fix that. It will just keep running that way. It will just keep consuming everything around it.
Let's throw a couple of proposals in here. So somewhere in the near future, the general population works out what's really going on. Could this technology be used against the system? In other words, the general public says, well, now that you're an elected politician, we will put this technology into your brain so we can control what you're thinking at all times, which is part of the collective pulse. In other words, we stop, it's no longer the tail wagging the dog, it's back to the dog wagging the tail. Can this technology therefore be used for good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely ways you could use this technology for good. I've even, say, an emergency, say a tsunami is coming. It's 30 minutes away. You need to evacuate a town of 100,000 people. What is the most efficient way to evacuate 100,000 people but take over their minds and have a computer guide everybody to the safest area? And it'd probably take 30 minutes or so. But if given, you know, if everybody's up for their own, then you get in a traffic jam and nobody moves and everybody dies in the tsunami. That's one example of how it actually could be good, but that involves you directly giving your consent. I give my consent to have this AI system guide me to safety for my own personal protection. I consent to that. This is non-consensual, and that's a very big difference. But I personally, you know, even if I were in a war, and I was fighting an enemy, and that enemy was using this technology, I would not use this technology against them, it can only lead to self-destruction. And that's my point. Everybody who has tried to use this technology has ended up in an authoritarian dictatorship with no liberties. We need to respect, you know, nature has given us freedom of thought. Nature and God has given us this ability to be reflexive and to think about things. And in that process, to discuss these things with other people and get more information, as everybody has all these different perspectives on things, which we all gain from by seeing their perspectives.
Absolutely. Now, Michael's book is called Battle Space of Mind. We'll see if we can put it up on screen for you. Michael, probably the last big question we'll get out. We've only got about 3 minutes left. Can you explain what Havana syndrome is? Because it seems that it's also hotly disputed as a real deal.
Yeah. Havana syndrome was the use of some kind of energy in the American embassy in Havana that affected the biology of the State Department employees there, and in other places it's happened. It is the same technology. They believe that it is an electromagnetic microwave-based system. They say they don't know exactly who has done it. It could be anybody. It could even be people trying to create trouble between Cuba and America. It could be some third party. That's the thing you have to always look at. You have to look at the whole, who can be doing this. You know, you can't just make assumptions that it's black and white all the time, because it's a hidden technology and covert, and anybody could be behind it.
Now, people will often say, certainly out there in the real world, ignorance is bliss. Knowing what you know now in your career as in signals intelligence, a software engineer, and this incredible book, how do you look at a statement like that and think that being ignorant can serve anyone? Are we really just selling ourselves short by not wanting to understand what's going on, or at least rebuild trust in institutions and individuals that can really explain what's actually happening out there?
Well, I think we have to understand that if people are using this technology to control other people, that most of the people whose ideas that we think are their ideas are not their ideas. Their ideas are programmed into them. So first you would have to break down the system just to get to know who we're really dealing with and to know yourself. Because if you can imagine, if a system is influencing you, half of your beliefs may not even be what you really believe in as a natural person. It just takes time. It's going to take time and a lot of effort. And we have to understand that maybe a third of the population could be directly under the direct influence of these systems. And there's nothing you can do with them unless you can sit them down and put a countermeasure on their head or destroy the system itself so it's not functioning anymore and people can go back to being free-thinking individuals with their own thoughts and their own personalities.
We are really living science fiction, science fantasy in real life, as we understand that the more we think we know, the more the cover stories come out. And Michael has addressed that by saying how pseudoscience is the term used to get you to look in another direction. Well, his book is something that should be in everyone's direction. It is complicated, but it is a reference tool that everyone should get hold of. Michael McCarron, I want to thank you for your time today, or your time this morning over there on the east coast of the US. And for our viewers, please check it out. Michael McCarron's book, Battle Space of Mind. It is an absolute ripper, a must have. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'll have another guest on the other side. Dave Hodges will be joining me to get into the details of what's coming up. So thank you, Michael McCarron, and thanks everyone for watching. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.